The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're wrestling with a really fundamental question, one that kind of defines modern data analysis. How do we figure out if X truly causes Y when, you know, we can't just run a perfect lab-controlled experiment?
Yeah, that really is the ultimate challenge, isn't it? We're diving into the essential work of Paul R. Rosenbaum on causal inference and, specifically, the rigorous design of observational studies.
Mm-hmm.
And look, for anyone who's ever been frustrated by that old academic line, you know, correlation does not equal causation, this deep dive, well, it offers a framework for actually moving past that, for making reliable, honest causal claims.
And it's so important because this isn't just theory, right? It affects almost every major decision you read about. Should the government implement a new policy? Does this popular diet actually help?
Exactly. You can't randomize countries for a carbon tax or, you know, force half the population to smoke for 50 years. You almost always have to rely on observational data watching what happens in the real world.
So the mission here really is to give you the tools to see through the noise, to find the most credible path to knowledge when all you have is this messy, imperfect data.
And Rosenbaum's work gives us a precise roadmap for doing just that, for drawing conclusions that can actually stand up to scrutiny.
Okay, so let's talk about the person who drew this map. Who is Paul R. Rosenbaum?
Well, he's a world-renowned statistician, currently the Robert G. Putzel Professor of Statistics at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. But really, more than the title, he's a foundational architect of this whole field.
A real pioneer.
Yeah.
And his contributions, they sound genuinely revolutionary. When we talk about his key work, what are the maybe two biggest ideas that really put him on the map?
Okay, first, he co-authored the seminal 1983 paper that introduced the propensity score. That single tool just completely changed how researchers could handle, like, dozens, sometimes hundreds, of messy, uncontrolled variables all at once.
Wow. Okay, and the second?
Second, and maybe even more profound, he developed the formal methods for sensitivity analysis for hidden bias.
Sensitivity analysis? That sounds like the intellectual safety net for researchers. Is that fair?
It is, yeah. But what really makes his perspective stand out, his defining contribution maybe, is this relentless focus on design over analysis.
Design over analysis, okay.
Yeah, he sees causal inference fundamentally as a design problem. He argues pretty forcefully that the critical work isn't the complex stats you run at the end, it's the meticulous effort you put in before you even peek at the outcomes, mm-hmm. just constructing groups that are truly comparable.
That sets up his central argument really nicely. We all kind of accept randomized controlled trials, RCTs, as the gold standard because they, you know, magically eliminate bias. But Rosenbaum's saying, hold on, don't give up just because you can't randomize. We can draw reliable causal conclusions from non-randomized observational data if we meticulously design the study to mimic an experiment.
Exactly. And the reason we have to work so incredibly hard at that design is because of the main villain in this story. Confounding or, mm-hmm. you know, selection bias.
Right.
Think about comparing, say, people who choose to exercise daily versus those who don't. Those two groups are just different from the get-go, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. Motivation, maybe income, access to a gym, loads of things.
Things that often have nothing to do with the specific exercise itself, but they're tied to both who chooses to exercise and the health outcome you're looking at.
So those pre-existing differences, the confounders, they're what mess everything up. They make it look like the exercise caused the good outcome, when maybe it was really the underlying motivation that caused both the exercising and the good outcome.
Precisely. And Rosenbaum's framework is basically a step-by-step guide to tackle this.
Okay.
Step one, use the propensity score to balance out everything you can see and measure.
Okay.
Step two, use sensitivity analysis to honestly quantify the risk from the stuff you can't see, the unobserved confounders.
It's like a process for intellectual transparency, making all the assumptions clear.
Absolutely. Let's start with the foundation, though, the conceptual bedrock, the potential outcomes framework.
Right. This is sort of the core logic. It sounds fancy, but it's surprisingly simple, isn't it?
It is. For any person, there are always two potential outcomes.
Mm.
What would happen if they got the treatment? We call that Y. And what would happen if they got the control? Y. The causal effect is just the difference between those two. Y minus Y.
But crucially, we only ever see one of those for any single person. If you took the pill, we see Y. We can never see what would have happened to you if you hadn't taken it. Your Y.
Exactly. So causal inference is fundamentally a problem of missing data. We're always missing half the picture for everyone.
And that's why randomization is like magic in an RCT. Because while it doesn't solve the missing data for one person across the whole group, it makes the treatment and control groups statistically identical on average, comparable in every way, the stuff we don't see before anyone even gets the treatment. It isolates the effect.
Perfectly put. So the challenge in observational studies is dealing with the two kinds of bias that randomization normally just wipes away for us. There's overt bias. The things we can measure, like age, income, health status.
The obvious stuff.
Yeah. And then there's hidden bias, the stuff we can't measure, like maybe genetic predispositions or inherent personality traits like grit, or maybe just unrecorded health habits.
Okay, let's make that concrete. Imagine comparing, say, surgery outcomes between a top-tier university hospital and a small local clinic. The patients choosing the top hospital might be sicker to begin with, or maybe wealthier, or have better insurance. Those are overt confounders. But maybe they also have more family support, which is harder to measure, that could be a hidden confounder. Both distort the comparison of the surgery's effect itself.
Exactly. And that leads us right back to Rosenbaum's core principle. Design trumps analysis. You absolutely have to build those comparable groups first before you even think about analyzing outcomes. Avoids fishing for results later.
I get the philosophy. I really do. But practically, statistically, how on earth do you take like 50 different variables, age, income, health history, education, you name it, and somehow match people across two groups that weren't randomized? It sounds, well, almost impossible.
It does sound impossible. And that's where the propensity score comes in. It's the workhorse tool. It's this monumental simplification Rosenbaum and Rubin gave us.
Okay, break it down. What is it?
Simply put, it's the conditional probability, the chance of any given individual receiving the treatment based on all their observed background characteristics, all those covariates you mentioned.
So wait, instead of trying to match someone on 50 different things, you calculate this one single number, this propensity score, that summarizes their likelihood of getting the treatment based on all those 50 things.
Exactly. The genius is that this single score acts like a summary index.
Yeah.
And the really powerful part is the propensity score theorem.
Okay.
It basically proves that if you can find two people, one treated and one control, who have the same propensity score, then those two people will also be balanced on average across all those dozens of underlying observed variables you use to calculate the score.
Wow. So you collapse this huge, messy, multidimensional matching problem down into matching on just one dimension, the propensity score.
You got it. And now you can use practical methods like pair matching. Find a person who got the treatment, then find someone who didn't, but has an almost identical propensity score. Pair them up.
Or stratification, maybe grouping people into bands based on their scores.
Yep. Or weighting. There are different techniques, but the goal is the same. Use the propensity score to create these pseudo-experimental groups that look remarkably similar before the treatment difference. You're essentially engineering a fair comparison from observational data.
Okay, that makes sense for the stuff we can see and measure, but here's the part that always nags at me, the big critique. Even if we perfectly match on everything observable, there's always that ghost in the machine, right? The potential for some unobserved confounder, that hidden variable, to be the real reason for the difference we see. That's the Achilles heel, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And that's the criticism critics always level quite fairly at observational studies. So what is Rosenbaum saying?
Yeah, what's the answer to that what if?
He insists on, well, intellectual honesty. He says researchers cannot just wave their hands and ignore hidden bias or hope it isn't there. They have to formally confront it. And this is where his perhaps most significant contribution comes in, sensitivity analysis.
Okay, so sensitivity analysis. It's not about eliminating the hidden bias, because you can't. It's about measuring the toughness, the resilience of your finding against potential hidden bias.
That's a great way to put it. It's basically a quantitative thought experiment. It asks and tries to answer a very specific question. Okay, I found an effect. Now, how strong would some hypothetical unmeasured confounder have to be, both in how much it influences getting the treatment and how much it influences the outcome, to completely wipe out my finding, to make my result disappear?
How do they actually quantify that resilience? Is there like a score or a metric?
There is. They typically use the gamma parameter, Austrian as the Greek letter R. Think of awe as the robustness rating for your study's conclusion.
Okay, gamma.
A 0.5 is how much that hypothetical unmeasured confounder would have to increase the odds of someone getting the treatment compared to someone else just like them, except for this hidden factor.
So a higher gamma means the finding is less sensitive, more robust.
Exactly. If your study's main conclusion, like this drug reduces mortality, still holds up, statistically speaking, even when you assume a hypothetical confounder that doubles or triples the odds of getting the treatment, so RA2 or RE3, then your finding is considered pretty robust. It would take a really strong hidden bias to explain it away.
Okay, let's use that classic example to really nail this down. The huge smoking and lung cancer debate back in the 1950s.
Oh yeah, perfect illustration. You had R.A. Fisher, an absolute giant in statistics, arguing against the causal link.
Right. He said because the studies were just observational, comparing smokers to non-smokers, you couldn't rule out some hidden genetic factor.
Yeah, his argument was maybe there's a gene that makes people both crave nicotine and be inherently susceptible to lung cancer. Yeah. So the smoking and the cancer were correlated, sure, but maybe not causally linked. The gene was the hidden confounder.
So he was essentially saying you can't prove causation without a randomized trial, which obviously wasn't feasible. But then Cornfield and others came along and effectively performed an early version of sensitivity analysis.
They did. They turned Fisher's argument around and asked, okay, if such a gene existed and was the sole explanation, how strong would its effect have to be? And they calculated that this hypothetical gene would need to be associated with smoking likelihood and cancer risk to an astronomical degree, far, far stronger than any known risk factor for cancer at the time.
So they didn't prove the gene didn't exist.
No, you can't prove a negative like that.
But they showed that believing in it as the sole explanation required accepting something biologically almost absurdly powerful. It shifted the burden of proof.
Exactly. It moved the debate from this vague, unknowable, what if there's a hidden confounder, to a quantifiable challenge. Okay, show me a confounder that strong. Is it plausible? That's the power of sensitivity analysis.
That focus really clarifies the key themes running through Rosenbaum's work, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Let's take them off.
Okay, theme one. Causality is fundamentally a design problem. It hammers home that the credibility isn't about the fancy model you run last. It's all about the meticulous care you took up front to build those comparable groups.
Couldn't agree more. Theme two, transparency about bias. Especially the bias you can control. You must use tools like propensity scores. You must show your work, check the balance on all the things you measured, and be totally upfront about how well you controlled that overt bias. Get the checkable part perfect.
Yeah, nail the part you can nail. Theme three, confront hidden bias head on. Sensitivity analysis isn't optional. It's the mandatory step. It's what forces intellectual honesty and separates a rigorous scientific argument from, well, just guessing or hoping.
And super relevant today, theme four, the peril of big data. Just because you have millions of data points doesn't mean you've solved the bias problem.
Right.
Big data can just mean you're replicating a huge existing bias with scary precision. Bad design flaws don't magically disappear with more data. Design principles are king.
Let's pull out a few specific quotes or ideas from Rosenbaum that really capture this philosophy. What sticks with you?
Okay, here's one that sums up the whole goal. The objective of an observational study is to approximate the design of a randomized experiment. It's not just data mining. You're actively trying to construct that fair comparison.
I like that. It reframes the whole task. And I love how he defines what sensitivity analysis gives you. A sensitivity analysis tells us how large that hidden bias would have to be to alter our conclusion. It shifts the focus from seeking absolute certainty, which is impossible, to measuring the robustness of your claim.
Yeah, it's about credibility under pressure. And here's a great one for focusing effort. Balance on observed covariates is a tangible, checkable property. Causal conclusions, by contrast, depend on untestable assumptions about unobserved covariates.
Ah, so put your energy into the part you can actually demonstrate and prove, getting that balance right on the things you can see.
Exactly. Do the checkable part meticulously.
Okay, let's bring this home. How does this whole framework actually apply in our everyday lives? We're constantly bombarded with headlines like, you know, coffee drinkers live longer, or red wine prevents heart disease.
Right. And now you, the listener, have a critical consumer checklist. When you see that headline, your first thought shouldn't just be, oh, great, It should be, wait a minute, was this an observational study?
Okay, step one.
Did they actually try to compare similar groups? Did they use something like matching to make sure the coffee drinkers and non-drinkers were similar in terms of, say, income, exercise habits, maybe education, pre-existing health?
Or is it just selection bias? Maybe healthier, wealthier people are just more likely to drink coffee regularly and live longer for other reasons.
Precisely. If the study didn't rigorously address confounding, the headline might be completely misleading.
And what about in, say, business or public policy? Evaluating a new tutoring program for students, or maybe a company rolling out new software.
Same logic applies. The company says, our new CRM software increased sales by 20%. The immediate question is, was that 20% increase caused by the software?
Or was it selection bias? Did the most motivated, already high-performing sales teams jump on the new software first, while the struggling teams stuck with the old system?
Exactly. If they just compare outcomes between the early adopters and the laggards, it tells you almost nothing about the software's true effect. You need a study that used methods like propensity score matching to compare teams that adopted the software to similar teams based on prior performance, motivation metrics, etc., that didn't. Only then can you start talking credibly about causation.
So, boiling it down, our mental checklist when we encounter any causal claim from observational data should be something like, one, experiment or observation.
Right.
Two, what are the obvious potential confounders? What makes these groups different besides the treatment?
Right.
Three, did they actually try to deal with those confounders seriously? Did they use matching, stratification, weighting based on propensity scores show their work?
Yeah.
Four, how robust is the claim? Did they do a sensitivity analysis? How big would a hidden bias have to be to wash away the result?
That checklist transforms you from just passively accepting headlines to being an active, critical evaluator of the evidence. It's empowering.
Thinking back on all this, for me, the biggest aha moment is still the propensity score itself. Just the elegance of boiling down potentially dozens of complex variables into that single manageable score. It makes the seemingly impossible task of creating comparability feel genuinely achievable.
Yeah, it's a powerful tool.
Yeah.
For me, I think the most valuable lesson is the emphasis on intellectual honesty, embodied by the sensitivity analysis. It's a framework that acknowledges we can't achieve the perfection of an RCT in many real-world settings, but it demands rigor and transparency anyway. It shows that causal inference isn't magic. It's about building a careful, reasoned argument based on transparent assumptions and, most importantly, meticulous design. It's about making the strongest possible case, honestly.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.